Welcome, everyone, to the Our Strange Skies podcast. I'm your host, Rob Christofferson, and I got a special interview for you today. I'm joined by Mark O'Connell. He's the author of The Close Encounters Man. He's written for Star Trek Deep Space Nine, The Next Generation, co-executive producer of UFO Witness on Discovery Plus, and he's appeared on it many times. And he has his own podcast called Farfetch. So, Mark, thank you for joining me today, man.
Thanks, Rob. It's great to be here. I appreciate Richard connecting us.
Absolutely. You have the honor on this podcast of being only one of two books featured in our book club, the UFO book club. Going back to 2018, we did The Close Encounters Man, and it was a book that impressed us a lot because what you did very well in that book is, you know, you told Hynek's story so well. You combine it with this history of UFOs and UFO research, and not to mention his contributions to astronomy and other stuff. So we commended you, man. And that's one of my favorite episodes, because I do recall calling Carl Sagan a turtleneck wearing son of a bitch at a point. But, you know, that's neither here nor there. But yeah, man, we love the book so much. It's taken us too long to get you on to this podcast, though. And I appreciate you making time, man, because I recently just re-listened to it through audiobook, and it's still a great book. So first and foremost, I got to ask, since, you know, you've written for Star Trek, you've written about UFOs. What came first, the love of Star Trek or the love of UFOs?
Oh, boy. I have a real hard time separating the two, you know? Mm-hmm. So I'm going to date myself. I was born in 1960. So that was sort of right at a high point in UFO activity and awareness. And for some, my mom was a librarian. I grew up in a very little town in Wisconsin. My mom was a librarian, and she would take me to the library with her all the time. And there was this one rack of books that I always gravitated towards. I don't know why, but it was the bookshelf that had the books about UFOs and Bigfoot and poltergeists and the Bermuda Triangle. You know, anything along those lines, there would be at least one or two books in that part of the library. And of course, I just read them all, and I read them all over and over again. I remember reading Brad Steiger's books, especially, being just like blown away, by all the crazy shit that he wrote about. So I think that's kind of where it started. And then, that sort of transferred into a love of science fiction. And, you know, in the early 60s, there wasn't a whole lot going on TV or movies that I had access to anyway, with science fiction. So when something like Star Trek came around, and it was like, I mean, we already had Lost in Space, but, you know, that was a pretty dopey show. But I watched it. I loved it. But I knew it was dopey. But then when Star Trek came along, it was like, this is cool. And it's not dopey. This is something really special. And I distinctly remember, this is the way I remember it anyway, Star Trek, the original Star Trek, NBC started showing it Thursday nights at 7:30 or 6:30, something like that. And I had a very strict bedtime. So when Thursday nights came around, I would have to go to bed like halfway through the new Star Trek episode, which was just killing me. And I can remember begging my parents, please, just one night, just Thursday night, can I stay up a half an hour longer just to see Star Trek? And I can't remember exactly, but I think I must have won that fight, because I'm pretty sure I got to see all the rest of the Star Trek episodes, you know, all the way to the end. So yeah, that's kind of my long, convoluted answer to your question. And it, And I still don't really know the answer to your question. I can just tell you what I remember, and that's how I remember it. They just sort of, the interest grew side by side, and, you know, it seemed to make sense that, you know, I was interested in both of these areas at the same time.
Yeah, and I mean, they complement each other so well that you know, it's hard not to see them side by side in many ways. And, like, you know, especially when you talk about when people talk about, like, you know, some, like, even the Betty and Barney Hill incident, you know, people claiming that it was, you know, inspired by, you know, an Outer Limits episode, which, you know, isn't really the case. But it's hard, you know, not to see that, especially with the stuff that was going on in the Twilight Zone. Also, they dealt with the subject so well. Tell me about, like, the first time that you got involved in writing for Star Trek. What was that like? What was that process like?
It was great. It was great. Well, I knew for a long time that I wanted to make movies. And when I was in college, I took a screenwriting course. First time I ever took a course like that, or even knew that a course like that existed. I was going to the University of Southern California at the time. And I took this screenwriting class. It was taught by this old guy who had been around writing movies and TV shows for decades and decades. And he just said, he had great, fascinating stories to tell. He never really talked a whole lot about how to write a script, as I recall. He was just basically reminiscing about his career in showbiz. But it didn't matter, because I started writing a script in that class, and that's what really got me interested. So I spent a long, long time trying to find an agent after I got out of college. I went into work in video production. So I was, you know, I was still doing fun media stuff. But at the same time, I was always on the lookout for an agent. Finally found an agent who liked my work and wanted to sign me on. And the first thing she said to me was, you've got to submit a script to Star Trek. Well, it turned out, this is what I learned, this is Star Trek The Next Generation we're talking about here. This is the early 1990s. And it turned out that Star Trek The Next Generation was one of the only, if not the only shows that would accept unsolicited scripts from anybody, whether you were represented by an agent or not. So even though I didn't need to have an agent, I worked through this with my agent. She persuaded me to write a spec script, that's a speculative script for Star Trek The Next Generation. I wrote the script, and my agent submitted it to Star Trek. And it took a few months for us to hear back, but when we finally heard back from the Star Trek producers, they said, hey, we like this script. We'd like you to come in and pitch some stories. And then they immediately give you the rule book. You know, they send you the show Bible, which the show Bible for Star Trek The Next Generation is really a thick, thick, big, heavy document. So you have to read all of this stuff and just absorb it all. And of course, obviously, you have to watch the show every week, so you're completely up to speed on, you know, the kinds of stories they want to tell, and, you know, and how they want to highlight each of the different characters and the relationships between the characters. So, so I had to do all that homework before I was ready to pitch, and they told me, okay, I could fly to LA or I could do the pitch over the phone. I ended up doing it over the phone from my kitchen table in Wisconsin. But it didn't matter, you know, they didn't care where I was. So they gave me some basic ground rules. They said, you can only pitch four stories and you only get one chance to pitch, because there are so many people in line behind you that we can't really let people have multiple tries. You get one try, and if you fail, you're out. So I was like, okay, I can live with that, because I don't have much choice. So I developed four stories. I pitched them to one of the producers, a guy named Joe Manosky. And I pitched all four stories, and Joe shot down all four stories.
Oh.
So I was pretty heartbroken. I had my one shot, and I didn't quite hit the target. But then Joe started saying, okay, here's what I want you to do next time. He goes, we need stories about this, and I want you to... And I was like, excuse me, what? It's like, I thought I only got one shot at this. And he goes, well, normally that's true. But he said, I really like your ideas. And he said, I want you to come back and try again. So that was all I needed. I was off and running. And it literally, I pitched for like the next year and a half, or maybe even longer than that. It was every 2 or 3 months, I would have 4 new stories that I'd be ready to pitch. And I'd make the pitch appointment, and I'd sit there at my kitchen table in Wisconsin and pitch and pitch and pitch. And every time it turned out the same, they'd be like, well, we can't use any of these stories, but we really like the way you think. So we want you to come back and try again. So I just, you know, first lesson for a struggling writer. If you get invited to try again, don't be chicken, you know, take your chance. So, you know, I just figured as long as they keep inviting me back, I'm going to keep coming back, whether they like it or not. So that's the long saga. It took a long, long time, and it took a lot of perseverance, but I finally had that magic day when I hit the right producer with the right story on the right day, and boom, they bought the story. And that turned into the Star Trek The Next Generation episode called Timescape. That was my first sale.
That's awesome, man. That's absolutely true, because a lot of stories that I hear from the people that, like, you know, go to Hollywood and they try to push stuff, they literally are just so persistent that somebody eventually, you know, takes a look and stuff. And you kind of gotta, if you really want to do it, that's kind of what you have to do. You have to, you know, push it until you annoy the hell out of them, basically.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot to that. And, you know, you have to feel your way along, you know, because you're walking this fine line of being persistent. You want to be persistent, but you don't want to be a pain in the butt. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a delicate balance to strike. I'm not sure if I ever totally struck it, but.
Hey, you wrote episodes, man. You got, they made episodes from your material. You did something right, man, you know, and that's important, you know, like, you made it happen, which is great. So transitioning to the Close Encounters, man, you know, this all begins, you go to the QFO's headquarters, which is really it's really one guy's house, you know, who's holding the files. I mean, it's different. The files have been moved, but what was that experience like walking in there? Cause you're looking for material for your blog. What was that experience like?
I was, you know, the old expression, like a kid in a candy store. That's really mm-hmm. what it was like. And it took a while to sink in after a couple of visits that, these are the personal letters of this famous person who I really admire. And I've just been given free access to all of this stuff. It was just amazing. And I can tell you the first time when I actually felt like lightning struck while looking through the QFO's files, they were all arranged alphabetically, and I get to the letter S, and I pull out this huge thick file folder labeled letter S, and the first tabs I see are Sagan and Spielberg. I thought, whoa, these are the two stories that I want to know about the most. And they just appeared in front of me, both in the same file folder, ready to go. So I start looking through these files, and the first one I do is Sagan, alphabetical order. And so I flip open the files. There's, you know, maybe an inch worth of correspondence and stuff in this file. And the first document on top is a letter that Dr. Hynek wrote, a copy of a letter that Hynek wrote to Dr. Sagan back in, I think, the early 1980s or somewhere around there. I'm going to get my dates wrong because it's been so long since I've done all that stuff. You can follow along. So there's this letter Hynek wrote to Sagan, and it's about this public appearance they had scheduled coming up in the next couple of months. And Dr. Hynek is requesting that they call a truce. for this public appearance. They're going to have a public debate about the UFO phenomenon. And Hynek is saying, can we please dispense with our personal feelings about this and just have an intelligent discussion about the phenomenon and hopefully give the people in the audience, you know, their money's worth and, you know, share some interesting ideas with the audience. That's what this is about. Well, I read that article and thought, wow, that's really amazing. So I go looking to see the letter that Carl Sagan wrote back to Dr. Hynek, and there isn't any. Sagan ignored Hynek's letter. They had this public appearance in Chicago, a public debate about UFOs, and Sagan just ripped Dr. Hynek apart on stage. He did not agree to Dr. Hynek's request to play nice. He played really, really dirty. So that was the first moment when lightning struck, and I thought, wow, this is a story people need to know. Then I went over to the Spielberg folder, and I flipped that one open, and the first letter on top of that stack is a copy of a letter from Dr. Hynek to Steven Spielberg. This is while Spielberg was in pre-production on the movie Close Encounters of the Third Kind. And Hynek writes to Spielberg and says, hey, Steve, I just found out that you're using some of my material from my book in your movie. I sure would have liked it if you had asked me first. You know, this letter, he's wording it so carefully. He doesn't want to call Spielberg a thief. But he's pretty pissed because Hynek's book, The UFO Experience, which had just come out just a year or two earlier, was the book in which Hynek introduced his whole concept of the close encounter and the three types of close encounter. So Spielberg comes along, appropriates that phrase from Hynek's book, uses it for the title, the working title of his movie. So I'm reading this letter. And in this case, there was a reply. Next page through the file, there's a letter from Spielberg back to Hynek saying, oh, I'm so sorry. I didn't know. One of my production assistants recommended that I read your book, and I just thought that term was so cool. I thought I'd use it for the title of my movie. But look, we're not going to use that title anyway. We're calling the movie Watch the Skies. So I hope that clears things up between us. And I thought, wow, this exchange is really, really fascinating. So I just kept going through. There was all sorts of paperwork involving their correspondence. And, you know, it turned out both guys got what they wanted. Hynek was hired on as technical consultant on the movie. He got to have his famous little 6-second scene at the very end at the secret UFO base. And Spielberg got to put Hynek's name on the movie, or, you know, in the movie, sort of as a seal of approval from the world's leading UFO expert. So those were the two moments when, like I said, those were the moments when lightning struck, and they were like early in the days of my researching the book. So finding those two files just made me realize there are millions of untold stories about J. Allen Hynek's life, and I want to tell them all. and Rob, it worked out so beautifully because I was living in Chicago at the time, and you're right, the Kufos files at the time were in two different basements of people's houses in Chicago. So I was able to just drive like 10-15 minutes and go to the Hynek archives, and then quickly discovered that Hynek had taught at Northwestern University for 25 years. Well, that was just a couple of miles away from me in the other direction. And then come to find out that Hynek had done his graduate work in astrophysics at the University of Chicago, which was also just a couple of miles from where I lived. So I was like at the epicenter of the J. Allen Hynek professional records collection. It was like all around me. And all I had to do was hop into my car and drive a few minutes and boom, I'd be there. And the archivists at the two universities were just amazing. The archivists at Northwestern just provided me with so much help and guidance. And, you know, there would be days when I would show up in the library archives at Northwestern, and the archivists would see me walk in and say, oh, Mark, I found something I think you'd be interested in. And it was great. And it was always something like, just like this pure gem that I could put into the book and that I never would have known about if it hadn't been for these archivists, you know, digging through things and helping me out finding things. It was an amazing experience.
Yeah. And like, when you think about that end of it too, because his contributions to astronomy don't really get talked about that much.
Yeah.
And to see that, you know, people appreciated that and to know like how much his students, even at Northwestern, loved him that much, you know, it's and there's, you know, this image of the guy that investigated these cases and tried to find answers, but there's also this very public looking image of him in which, you know, he's very personable. He can, you know, make money for universities and stuff like that. Like the picture that you painted was so great that, you know, you really got to know him in your book, which, you know, for someone like me who, at the time that I read your book, I knew J. Allen Hynek's name when I was maybe, I want to say, 12 or 13. I had watched the Unsolved Mysteries segment about the Lonnie Zamora incident. That's my introduction into all of this. And the one memory that I have is I was in middle school at the time, and we were doing this project where we were deconstructing Billy Joel's We Didn't Start the Fire, breaking it down by decade. And then the other part of it was, what would we introduce into that if we had the chance? So I, you know, in the early days of like internet web browsers and stuff, so this is like 1996 or so, going down into the school computer and typing in the name J. Allen Hynek to see if anything would come back, and nothing ever did. So he's just kind of this, like, you know, mythic figure in my head because I knew how important he was to the investigation of the case. And then years later, you realize, you know, how big a figure he was. And I know that, you know, you said you respected it, but like, you know, when you were doing that research, but what was your opinion of him at that time? What did you know of J. Allen Hynek?
I think what I probably knew him for mostly was the movie Close Encounters of the Third Kind. But also there was the one UFO case that really made, I was totally into this for, you know, my entire childhood, read every UFO book I could find. But the one incident that made it real for me was the Pascagoula, Mississippi abduction with Charles Hickson and Calvin Parker, which took place in October 1973. So I was 13 at the time. And I distinctly remember my mom always had this like news radio station on in her kitchen. And I distinctly remember like sitting in the kitchen because they were reporting on this UFO abduction, these two guys who've been kidnapped by aliens. And I was like, this is real. This isn't just something that happened like 10 or 20 years ago that I'm reading about in a book. This is something they're talking about on the nightly news. It's in the evening newspaper. It's everywhere. And that made the whole thing really, really real to me for the first time. And that's when I really started engaging. And I think that's probably when I first kind of got an inkling of who Hynek was and you know, what part he played in the whole drama.
Yeah. And I'm curious, when you were researching the book, was there anything in there that surprised you? Because there were a lot of things in the book that kind of surprised me, but what researching the book surprised you about Hynek?
Oh boy. Well, there, first of all, his spirituality. That was the first big surprise.
Yeah.
I had this image of him as just this very straight-laced scientist who only believed what he could, you know, hold in his own hands, only to find out that when he was a young graduate student working at Yerkes Observatory in southern Wisconsin, staring into this telescope all alone at night, he started to have some really, interesting thoughts about spirituality and mysticism. He got interested in the Rosicrucians. He was interested in, both of his parents had recently died right around the time he started college. So that was still, pretty fresh with him. And so he was reading about these religious themes and spiritual themes. And, they talked about things like, past life regression, or, being able to see the past, being able to connect with the past in, in physical ways. And so that was a big surprise. The fact that he's doing this serious astronomy work, but, and while he's doing that, he's also thinking all these really kind of far out spiritual thoughts at the same time. I thought that was really fascinating. So of course I wanted to find out how those two parts of his, character sort of came together. So that was a big one. I also really wanted to get to the bottom of the swamp gas case. Because there's been so much written about it, and I always had a feeling whenever I read about the swamp gas case in the mid 60s in Michigan, that there was something more to the story. Everything I read about that case and about Hynek's role in that case, it just never quite added up. It never quite rang true. And as an offshoot of that, because so many people believed that Hynek lied about it, I quickly realized that there were all sorts of people who just adore and respect Dr. Hynek, but there are also a whole lot of people who hate him, who are still mad at him for saying that those UFOs in Michigan were swamp gas. Mm. Because there are so many of those people, including one of his best friends, Jacques Vallée, who was really pissed off at him for saying swamp gas. So I knew there had to be more to the story there. It was just nothing I read added up. So when I started researching that case, the swamp gas case, I spent a lot of time researching that case. One of my goals with the book was to get new voices and new names into the conversation. People who had been there, but nobody bothered to talk to. Mm-hmm. And so with the swamp gas case, I was able to do that. In certain circumstances. And it just, when I started researching it, I realized how wrong most people were about the swamp gas case. Hynek, people will always differ on this, but in my humble opinion, when Hynek says swamp gas, he actually was saying the exact right thing. It was the only thing he could have said at that particular moment. It doesn't mean he was calling every UFO sighting swamp gas, but that's right. What a lot of people took it to mean. And that's why he got, he just got attacked so viciously. So those I say would be the two big things, is the mixture between his scientific pursuits and his spiritual pursuits, and this whole bit with the swamp gas case and whether he did the right thing or not. And whether people can accept the fact that the conventional wisdom about that case might be completely wrong.
Right. There are also elements to that case where I don't think a lot of people realize that Frank Manner's story wasn't as consistent as people believed it to be, because he kind of told it different ways to different news agencies and such. This story kind of changed a little bit, and then the Hillsdale case, he didn't really get to talk to that many witnesses. He only got to talk to two of them. So, and the way that, you presented that, you there's definitely a conspiracy afoot a little bit, what really happened. The dude's there with a broken jaw, he's got to do this press conference, and he's being rushed to give an explanation when most cases you would need more time to conduct a proper investigation. And it, like, In many ways, he got through that, he got what he wanted. He got his scientific study. The only thing was, is that, you know, the people responsible for that study, they didn't have the best intentions, you know, dismissing it up front. But one thing that really surprised me, because like, one thing that I say about him is like, he had a symmetrical life in the sense that, you know, he was born, you know, around the time that Halley's Comet arrived, and then, you know, he died shortly after it had come again. And, you know, like with like Mark Twain was very similarly born and died the same way. So there's that kind of like symmetry to it, which is always interesting to me. Like poetic in many ways. Like, it's weird how poetic the guy seemed to be in those kind of ways. Like these things that would pop up in his life, and you know, that just kind of, it made me admire him more. Like that's the one thing that your book kind of like drove home to me, because I, you know, I had read The UFO Experience by that time. Like, I was one of those nerds that got it out of the library every other week or something like that, because it's like one of the few UFO books that they actually have in my library in town. But again, I will like gush about your book for a long time going forward. When it comes to UFO Witness, you know, you're co-executive producer, you've appeared on, you know, many episodes. How did that project come to be? How did you get involved with UFO Witness?
Well, I actually started UFO Witness right around the time that my book was published, which was June of 2017. My agent and I started sort of looking around to see if there might be opportunities to either pursue some sort of film or TV project specifically about the book, like, you know, adapt the book as a TV series or something. I had so much unused material after 5 years of research, so much stuff that I couldn't fit into the book. So our second option was to see if we could sort of repackage the material that didn't get used in the book and create a whole new project out of that material. So we had talks with a couple of different movie and TV producers, and one of the production companies, Anomaly Entertainment, kind of sparked to the idea, the second idea of using the, you know, the additional material. Although in the end, it's kind of funny because we ended up sort of using both approaches on the show at the same time. But we had some talks with them. The talks died out. A couple of months later, we sort of reconnected, and they said, you know what? We actually want to do something with you. So we started working on the show, and the original concept for the show was that we would, as I did in the book, we would reenact a UFO event, a famous or not famous UFO event. Then we would talk to the eyewitnesses on camera, hear their version of the story, and then we would sort of look at, try to explain it in a scientific way. And so that, over the course of developing the show, though, you know, the network people get involved, and the showrunner gets involved, and, you know, the original concept, it sort of goes this way and then that way. So in the end, the show wasn't exactly what I had originally envisioned or pitched, but we were accomplishing some of the same things. The thing that made it most important for me was, if you'll recall, the first few episodes of season one, we had this wonderful woman in the show called Jenny Zeidman, who was, if you read my book, you know, she's one of Dr. Hynek's bestest friends all his life. And that's actually one of the big reasons that Travel Channel / Discovery Plus wanted to go ahead with the show, was the fact that we had Jenny Zeidman there. And we had access to the Kufos records. Because it turned out, okay, I'm sort of going on a tangent here. I hope you don't mind. As far as the Kufos records, the Kufos official records were concerned, bunch of them were in the basement of Mark Rodiger in this part of Chicago. A bunch of them were in the basement of Mary Castor in this part of Chicago. But there was a third massive collection at a home in Kalamazoo, Michigan. A Kufos stalwart, Michael Swords, who was like, he loved to collect things. And whenever anybody had anything they didn't have storage space for, they would call Michael and say, can you put this in your archives? So Michael Swords had probably an even bigger collection of material than the Kufos places in Chicago. So with all those pieces in place, oh God, what was the original question? I guess I do that to myself sometime. I tell this little sidebar story and I'm like, wait, what was I talking about to begin with?
You're talking about the material that you were using to...
So I was able to get access for the camera crew from Anomaly Entertainment in Kalamazoo to come into the archives in Kalamazoo. So basically, and another wrinkle to this whole thing is right when the show went into production, that's right when I was diagnosed with lymphoma for the first time. So the original concept of the show was that Ben Hansen and I would be investigating the cases together. Well, when I was diagnosed with cancer, we had to do a quick rethink. And the way it ended up, you'll see in those early episodes, is that I ended up being sort of the wise old librarian character who was like in charge of the archives. And when Ben hit a stumbling block in his investigations, he would come to Kalamazoo to pick my brain. And I'd be like, why, yes, Ben, we happen to have an account of that case right here in the archives, and then Ben and I would go through it together and we'd this is what really happened. And, so that was obviously the show evolved quite a bit from the first time we pitched it to Anomaly to the time it finally made it on the air. But it changed a lot, but it was always fun. It was always a ton of fun. And just for me, getting Jenny Zeidman on camera, even to talk for as briefly as she did, that to me was huge. And again, that was one of the reasons that finally persuaded Discovery Channel to go ahead with the show, because this was something unique. This was someone who actually was part of Project Blue Book, not officially,
right?
But yeah. She was absolutely a part of Project Blue Book. She could rightly call herself a Blue Book investigator. And so to get her was just an amazing thing. And that for me, that was the most important part of the show.
She wasn't really that much of a public necessarily figure when it comes to this stuff. Am I right on that?
Yeah, she was fine with that.
she was totally fine with that. Yeah, but she investigated, she wrote, a bit on UFOs. Like I remember stumbling upon, it was like an entry in Ohio MUFON's page, right, about, I think it was alluding to Hynek and Wernher von Braun getting together, talking about rocketry or something like that. But like she was that person that had the inside info because he pretty much confided in her for like his entire life, it was amazing. And like one of the first, I think it was the first episode for it about the coin helicopter case, she wrote extensively about that. She wrote it. I used her articles for the episode that we did for our Year of the Humanoid series, because it's such a fantastic case that, led to like the one of the, main witnesses testifying in front of the UN. So it's like,
it was a big deal. And Jenny's investigation of that case was really a high watermark for not just for Kufos, but for UFO research in general. I mean, she really set the bar high.
Yeah, no, she absolutely did. So I'm curious, like, did you get to know her at all, like when you were researching the book and such? And, you know,
fun story.
Like, yeah.
Fun story. Again, going back to those early days, digging through the files in Kufos headquarters, when I came across the Sagan file and the Spielberg file, also in the midst of all these files was this big lime green three-ring binder. Of course, that caught my eye. I was like, oh, this must be something interesting. So I flip it open, and at first I'm kind of confused. I can't tell who's writing these letters, but I quickly realize it's clearly a very good friend of Dr. Hynek's. Her name is Jenny Zeidman. She worked with Dr. Hynek on many of his Project Blue Book investigations. And she knows a hell of a lot about UFOs. She's kind of, you know, she's kind of one of these living history kinds of people who, like, she was there, she saw it, she remembers it all. But it took me a really, really long time to, first of all, to find out if she was still alive, and then to find out how to contact her. Well, I finally contacted her. I found that she was living in Columbus, Ohio, and I called her up, and I kind of caught her off guard, of course, but I told her that I was writing a book about Alan Hynek and that I would really love to hear her reminiscences about Dr. Hynek, about working with him. And then I thought, well, this will convince her. I said, and I'm writing this book with the cooperation of Kufos. And boy, it turned out that was the wrong thing to say. I had no idea. Because she was very polite about it, but she said, well, you know, I've written a lot about those days. Those articles have, you know, for the most part been published in the MUFON Ohio newsletter. So she said, feel free to go through all of those. You can quote anything you want there. And I said, well, thank you. That's really wonderful. But I would still love to interview you now, because I'm sure your memories and your perceptions have probably changed. You've had all these years to, you know, think about the things you saw. Maybe things mean different things to you now. And she hung up on me.
Ah.
And I sat there, you know, looking at my phone for a few seconds thinking, should I call her back? Should I push it? Should I call her back, or should I leave it be? And I just decided, well, some people want to leave the past in the past, and I don't really have any right pestering her about that. So I did as she said. I found all of her writing, and it's wonderful writing, and it's all available online. Mm-hmm. I found her writing for the Ohio MUFON chapter. It includes, you know, she's got a really vivid account of the coin helicopter case, among other things. So I was able to use several of those quotes in the book. And I thought they added a lot of really wonderful things to the story of Hynek, you know, because she brought out things about him personally that I would never would have, you know, known about otherwise. So the book gets published. A couple of weeks after the book comes out, I get a call from a guy who says, hi, I'm Barry Zeidman. I'm Jenny Zeidman's son. She'd really like to talk to you. Can I give her your contact information? And I was like, Rob, I was scared to death. I was like, I don't want her calling me. She hung up on me. I don't want her calling me up. But I thought, okay, well, I've got to do this. So I gave Barry my contact info. A couple days or a couple weeks later, I got an email from Jenny Zeidman, and I got terrified again. I was like, do I really want to read this? Am I ready for this? And I start reading her email, and it just blew me away. She said, Mark, congratulations on the book. I just read it. She said, you wrote Alan exactly as I remember him. And I, you know, my jaw hit the floor. I was just stunned. What a fantastic review. To have his best friend say that about the way I told his life story, that just blew me away. And I was still getting over that 2 weeks later when she wrote to me again and she said, Mark, I just finished the book for the second time. And for the second time, I ended up in tears. So after that, Jenny and I became pen pals. Strangely enough, she would every once in a while, I'd get a package in the mail and it would be, you know, a letter that Alan had written to her that hadn't ended up in the files, you know, because it was more of a personal nature or whatever. So she would send me these, you know, these really fun documents about her, you know, her correspondence with Hynek. And so when we started talking about a TV show, actually this is pre-TV show, I decided I was going to, I knew she was camera shy. So I said, look, you have a lot more stories to tell. If you don't tell the stories yourself, they may get twisted and changed in ways you don't like. So I said, I'm going to give you an opportunity to make sure you get your truth on the record. I said, can we just do a lengthy interview and then I'll write a story based on, you know, a story based on your interview that we can publish online or maybe in a publication somewhere. And she was agreeable to that, but she said, let's just do it over email. That way I can, you know, think things through and stuff. So we started for about 3 or 4 months. We had this really intense email correspondence going on. And then the TV show started sort of becoming a reality. And I called her up and I said, Jenny, you know, that interview we've been doing, what if you could do that same thing on camera? I said, it looks like this thing's coming together. We could send a camera crew to Columbus. We'll do it in your home. And amazingly, she agreed. I think the idea, that the way I posed it to her was that if you let somebody else tell your story, they might not get it right. So here's your chance to tell it the right way. I guess that really swayed her. And so that's how she ended up on the show. And that was, again, one of our final selling points to the Travel Channel was like, look, we have like one of the oldest surviving Blue Book investigators ready to sit down in front of the camera and talk about her experiences.
Yeah. And that's like, it's amazing because, yeah, we never really got to see her in like any other capacity other than her writing. So it was really, you know, a joy to see her on camera and talking about that case. And in particular, the coin case, because like she brought up like some kind of like psychic elements to the case that were really pretty fascinating that I had never heard before and such, but
and she found other witnesses. She just went above and beyond, man.
She did. So, you know, one question that I have to ask.
Okay.
Is Jacques Vallée really pissed off at you? Because
yes. I thought you might bring that up. Yeah, so, well, you know, if he thinks about me at all, which he probably doesn't, he's usually generally pretty pissed at me. For a couple of years after the book came out, I would get a nasty letter from him every couple of months saying, you know, your book is wrong. You need to recall every copy of the book and issue a correction. And I'd be like, I can't do that. Right. You think I can make that decision to pull back every copy of the book and change it? No. So I guess I got to tell your listeners the whole story.
Please.
So you're probably all or most of you familiar with the Steven Spielberg film Close Encounters of the Third Kind. And as I mentioned earlier, Dr. Hynek was technical advisor on the movie. He was on set for a number of days in Alabama. He obviously met and got to know Steven Spielberg. It was a real high water mark for Hynek's career to be involved in this movie. But one of the main characters in the movie is a French ufologist played by the movie director, François Truffaut. So the character's name is Lacombe, Claude Lacombe in the movie. And everyone, since the minute the movie came out and was projected onto the first movie screen, everybody has just assumed that the character in the movie, the French ufologist, was inspired by Jacques Vallée because he was a very prominent voice in the UFO field and he was French. And so it was logical to assume that there was a connection. I always thought that was the case. I never thought anything otherwise. But then when I was researching, I spent a lot of time. I've been a fanboy, a science fiction fanboy for a long, long time. Okay. I used to buy magazines like Starlog, any kind of magazine about science fiction or horror movie, any kind of genre movies. I was there, man. I bought it and I kept it. I kept it sealed up and protected. I still have all of those magazines. I still have almost a complete run of Starlog. But there's this one odd little magazine just called, I think it's just called Fantasy and Science Fiction Film. And I happen to have a copy of that that was like a special issue dedicated to the movie Close Encounters of the Third Kind. And I was like, oh, that's the part of the book I'm writing right now. I bet I can find a few little, you know, tidbits of information here that I can put into the book. So I'm reading, I'm going through this magazine, and boom, they interviewed J. Allen Hynek. Like, this is better than I could have expected. So I start reading the interview with Dr. Hynek. And at one point in the interview, the interviewer says, now, is it true that one of the characters in the movie is based on a real life colleague of yours, the French character? And I'm like, well, I know what Hynek's going to say. He's going to say, yes, Jacques Vallée. But instead, Dr. Hynek says, yes, Claude Toher. He said, that's the scientific connection. He represents the scientific connection in the UFO mystery, Claude Toher. Claude Toher was a French astronomer who was probably most famous in UFO circles as he for a short time, he was the head of the French government's official UFO study group. It's either GEPAN or GAIPAN. I can't remember. I can never remember the acronym. Mm-hmm. But so Claude Toher was, like I said, Claude Toher was the head of the French government's UFO study group. So a very credible voice in UFO world, just like Jacques Vallée. But that's the person that Spielberg based the French character on, Claude Toher, not Jacques Vallée. So I felt like, well, I have to put this in the book because this is Hynek himself saying this. This isn't third person. This is Hynek himself telling this reporter, yeah, this is the real story here. So I put that in the book and wow, Jacques Vallée was not happy. He just started sending me these really furious emails, like I said earlier, demanding that I pull the book back out of print and issue a correction. And I told him over and over again, I said, Jacques, you're acting as though you think I said this.
Right.
I did not say it. Your bosom buddy, J. Allen Hynek, said Claude Toher. I did not say that. You got to get this straight in your head. And he just never did. So for a while it got really heated. There was lots of emails going back and forth. And at one point, Jock even dragged George Knapp into it.
Oh God.
We're sending these emails back and forth. And all of a sudden I noticed there's another line on the two line in the emails, like George Knapp. And I asked Jock, I said, what's up with this? Why is George Knapp suddenly into this conversation? He's like, well, I just wanted to have a witness. I wanted to have a third party. Like, okay, but it doesn't change anything. Right. Hynek still said what he said. It's Claude Toher. So, yeah, you can tell I kind of get a kick out of telling the story because ultimately I know it's a big deal to Jacques. I get it. I mean, he's built his whole character, his whole career around the idea that he, you know, inspired this character in the movie, but I'm sorry, you didn't.
Right. Like your buddy distinctly said that it wasn't you. It was the other guy.
Yeah. And he said it, by the way, he also said it without any hesitation.
Right.
You know, Hynek didn't have to think about how he was going to answer that question. He was just like, oh yeah, Claude Toher.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe it's Pohe. I don't know. It's a French name. I could be slaughtering the pronunciation. I don't know.
Right.
But Hynek and Toher had actually met years earlier. And I mentioned this in the book, they had met years earlier at Cape Kennedy when they were both working on different space science projects. And they actually had a talk at that time about UFOs, specifically about the Condon Committee report. I always thought that was kind of a fascinating little tidbit.
Yeah. And like, it's just so wild that he would get that upset about it. But like, Jacques Vallée, and I don't want to, you know, speak ill of the man, but Jacques Vallée values Jacques Vallée a lot, especially if you read like his journals and stuff. Like,
oh yeah,
Yeah, you totally understand. He definitely levied a lot of criticism at Hynek, even though they, you know, they were pretty close friends. You know, you included some of that in your book, like you know, the debate with Sagan and how I wouldn't have shown up. Like I respect the guy's work. I, you know, like he's got a body of work that is compelling, that is it really makes you think. Like he's one of those guys that, you know, theorizes, uses cases to you know, exemplify that, and like he's the main reason why people compare fairy stories to alien abduction accounts. Like he's he's that guy. So like, you know, nothing but respect. He did actually shoot. It's not that he shot me down. They did a bait and switch. I was supposed to interview him like a month and a half ago, and it just didn't happen. But you know, it is what it is. Nothing against him, but like, you know, too, like a lot of people know Jacques Vallée, but I don't think a lot of people know Aimé Michel, who, you know, is who should be as revered in French ufology as anybody, you know, wrote two really compelling books. The second one on a theory that, you know, ultimately didn't pan out and kind of fell through the you know, orthotony, the straight line mystery and all that stuff. But like just a very influential figure.
I think part of Vallée's problem is that I think deep down he was always very jealous of Dr. Hynek, strictly in terms of the amount of media attention he got.
Yeah.
Everybody always went straight to Hynek with their UFO questions to report their cases. Nobody ever went to Vallée. Everybody went straight to Hynek. And I became kind of aware of that because when I read Vallée's books, I think pretty much all of them, it was all like one after another in a straight line because I was at that point in my research, you know, okay, this is Jacques Vallée time. And when you read all of his stuff, you know, all of his books end to end, and read all of his comments about Hynek appearing on TV, yada, yada, yada. It's hard not to think that there was a certain amount of envy and jealousy going on there. I'll just leave it there.
Mark, you tweeted out, you know, earlier, like a couple week or so earlier, that, you know, you were interviewed for 6 hours, 6+ hours by CNN. for a documentary that has yet to see the light of day, of like a 5-part series. So how did you get involved in, like, what did they sell you on when they showed up at your house to do this interview?
So this started like over a year ago now. I don't even remember who first contacted me. Probably I know, it was one of the producers of the documentary, this guy Lloyd, very nice guy. Contacts me and says, hey, we're producing this 5-hour, 5-part UFO documentary for CNN. And Leslie Kane recommended you to us. We wonder if you'd like to do an interview, you know, dealing primarily with, you know, your book and your work with UFO history, not necessarily dealing with current events, but dealing with, you know, UFO history, Dr. Hynek, Project Blue Book, all that stuff. And I was thrilled to be asked. I said, sure, I'd love to do that. And they said, okay, we're going to send a camera crew to your house for an entire day. And I was kind of like, whoa, okay, this is not what I was expecting at all, but this is really a serious production. So we set a date. It was September 2021. A huge, huge TV crew pulled in. Just took over the entire house. You know, I showed the director around the house. She's like, you know, in my office where I'm sitting right now, she's like, okay, we can do some stuff in the office. We can do some stuff in the basement because the basement's where I do my podcasting stuff. And then we'll finish up with stuff in the living room. I was like, wow, okay, that's a lot of work, but let's do it. Let's do it. So yeah, we spent the whole day talking. And as I said, it was primarily talking about like famous cases. You know, why is this case so famous? What's the significance of it? And, you know, I love talking about that kind of stuff. So I was having a blast. I was really, really enjoying the whole day. And then we get sort of towards the end of the day. We're on our final setup downstairs in the living room. And out comes the surprise. The director starts asking me about UFO current events, not history. She starts asking me about the Nimitz encounter and about Lou Elizondo and all of that stuff. And I was kind of like, okay, I don't know if you're going to like what I have to say.
Right.
Because the way she was presenting it to me, she was making it very clear that there was going to be a point of view in this show. And the director was, for some reason, blindly expecting me to support that point of view, which I didn't do. I said, you know, I've never really bought into that whole thing. I never got very excited about it the way a lot of people have. I said, she was like, oh, and the director's like totally floored by this. And she goes, why? What was your problem with it? And I said, the whole thing just seemed so carefully choreographed right from day one. I said, I could just never buy into it. It just felt like a manufactured moment. And I never wanted to get involved, never wanted to have anything to do with it because I didn't think there was anything to it. And she was kind of like, wow. Oh, okay. And I found out afterwards. See, I didn't know at the time. I knew that Leslie Keen had recommended me to these guys. So I knew Leslie was involved in the project. I didn't know anybody else they were interviewing. Turns out they did interview Luis Elizondo. So because of that, I have no idea. They've told me that I'm going to be in 2 out of the 5 episodes, but I have no idea what parts of the interview they're going to use, you know?
Yeah.
I'd be very surprised if they used the part where I was critical of of the current event. You know, this whole thing with Tom DeLonge and To the Stars Academy is like, come on, this is such a load of crap. give me a effing break. So, you know, and I just felt like, well, you came out here to interview with me. You apparently did not do your due diligence or you would have known what I was going to say. Because I haven't exactly been shy about it on Twitter.
No.
Or at the time in the blog that I was writing. So yeah, the whole interview ended on this kind of this weird, interesting note. And yeah, and then it was over and it was like, it's the end of the day. And then, you know, it took another hour for her crew to dismantle everything. The funny thing was, they were like, I found out very quickly that all the entire video crew had flown down from New York City. I said, wait a minute, you're shooting this for CNN. CNN's right down the road. I mean, right. I live in the outskirts of Atlanta. CNN is here. What the hell? And the director was like, oh, they do this all the time. They hire outside production companies to do, you know, special projects. And she's like, we're on their list. So, you know, we got this project. So, I mean, overall, it was a really fun experience. Like I said, when they just had me talking about UFO history, as you can tell from this interview, I'm ready to talk for hours. Sure, this is fun. I love talking about this stuff. But yeah, towards the end, it got a little weird. We'll see how they handle it. I don't know. I kind of hope they do include my comments on that because I think, you know, people need to hear that. But we'll see. If they decide not to use it, I guess I'll understand. Because like I said, they have a point of view and that's what they want to go with. So
as someone who is, you know, that UFO historian, what cases would you point people to say, hey, it seems like there's something going on here. There's something, you know, beyond, you know, your, you know, terrestrial explanation, you know, man-made. What cases do you point to that you would tell people to check out if they were, you know, wanted that perspective?
That's an easy one. I had mentioned earlier, the Pascagoula abduction case. That would be the one. And part of that was because, as I said before, that was the first UFO case that was, for me, that had occurred in real time. and the investigation and the reporting on it were taking place in real time. And for me, that was just like, oh, this is real. That's all I need to know. They're reporting this on this right now in the news. This is real. This just happened. So that case, most especially did it for me. I mean, there are others, the Lani Zamora, the Sicaro case, you had brought that up earlier. That's a great one. The coin helicopter case, Betty and Barney Hill has always been a favorite. I can tell you when I started, when you're selling a nonfiction book, when you're writing a novel, you have to write the whole novel before you try to pitch it to publishers. With a nonfiction book, I learned, you only have to write a couple of sample chapters. So the first sample chapter I wrote was Pascagoula. So that'll tell you right there, you know, what my favorite case was. That was the case that I really wanted to write about first. So I did. And it remains one of my favorite cases. I never got a chance to talk with Calvin when obviously Calvin appeared in one of the season two episodes of UFO Witness. Or maybe it was season one. I can't remember now. But at any rate, because of my cancer treatment, I wasn't able to be there. And that killed me. I really wanted to meet Calvin, really wanted to talk to him about that case. But yeah, that's always been a super convincing one for me. And one of the things that made it convincing, I don't know if you remember in my book, I ended up talking to the town attorney who represented yes. Hickson and Parker
yes.
in the aftermath of that, of their abduction. And that lawyer was awesome. You know, he was like, look, I just want you to know, I never charged them a penny. You know, basically we were all of us just looking out for these guys because we believed their story and we didn't want any harm to come to them. So he's like, I would run interference for him basically, but I never charged him a penny.
To be honest, my first exposure to that case was your book. I had never heard of the Pascagoula. Wow. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. And like by that time, I think I had been researching for maybe 2-3 years, and I had never come across that case because it's like it is like one of the more, you know, well-known abduction accounts. If you have to pick the big three from the 60s and the 70s, it's Betty and Barney Hill, Travis Walton, and Pascagoula. And I had never heard of it. And like when we recorded the book club episode, my buddy Angel is like, I had never heard of the Pascagoula incident. And it was just, wow. It's just this fascinating thing. And, that's one of my favorite episodes that we've done because I knew someone, the guest on for that one lived about, I think 45 minutes away from Pascagoula, and he ended up taking a trip down there. And, that entire area was kind of, there was a lot of activity in 73 in that area. And like, there's interesting ancillary accounts because I think it was like a month or so later that there was like a USO sighting in the same area.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. That's a cool detail.
Yeah.
And just, you know, for your listeners, there are probably at least a few of your listeners who maybe don't know this part of that story. So these two buddies were abducted by aliens, taken aboard a UFO, examined and, you know, left out on the pier where they were fishing, and left to try to figure out what the hell had just happened and who they could tell. And it's a really fascinating story. They ended up going to the local police department, and the police chief or the sheriff split them up. They interviewed them. They interviewed the two witnesses in separate rooms, proper police procedure, right? And then they put the two witnesses back together in the same room, and all the officers and sheriffs, they all left the room, just left these two guys alone. And the two guys start talking about what they had just experienced. And they're clearly, you can listen to those transcripts. These guys are terrified. They've just gone through a life-altering event. The sheriff, unbeknownst to anyone, had left a tape recorder running on record in that room because he was sure he was going to catch these guys in a hoax. But instead, they all listened to this tape afterwards, and they're all like, holy shit, these guys were telling the truth. And it was that recording, right? That it was that recording that has sort of made that case such a credible, I mean, for me at any rate, and I know for a lot of other people, that recording is like, put that case over the top. It's like, how can you deny something incredible, amazing, terrifying happened to these guys? Yeah. But listen, though, I want to add this one thing, because we had talked before about all the unused material I had when the book was done. There's another interesting story about Pascagoula. Rolling Stone magazine. Now, this story made national headlines, okay, as I've alluded to before. This story was headline news all across the country. Rolling Stone magazine sends a reporter to Pascagoula. And this reporter is this hotshot guy who ended up becoming a really rich Hollywood screenwriter years later. But he goes to Pascagoula, he interviews everybody, and he writes this story in which he just viciously rips everybody in Pascagoula to shreds. Because there are these pathetic country bumpkins and they'll believe anything. So, and he, the writer, you know, he's the sophisticated big city writer for Rolling Stone, you know. He knows better than everybody else. And his I have a copy of his article. It took me a long time to find it, but I found a copy of the article. This guy's vicious. Especially with Calvin and Charlie, the two abductees. This guy just tears them apart. It's the most disgusting bit of, I can't even call it journalism. It was just disgusting the way he treated these people.
Yeah.
That's the story.
Yeah. And like, even, you know, Carl Sagan did it when, you know, they went on the Dick Cavett show. And like, you know, that's nothing new. I've seen clips of Philip Klass destroying Ed Walters on Oprah, which, you know, whatever your opinions on Ed Walters is, it's like it's the traditional playbook of Philip Klass just labeling someone a liar and, you know, stuff. But like what I found interesting about Pascagoula when I did the research for that Year of the Humanoid series is that up until 1973, there really hadn't been years in which there were many multiple abductions taking place. But what I found is that there were five, and they all occurred within about a week of each other, which was very weird to me. There were a couple that there was one guy in Alabama who had his entire truck abducted with him, and he was kind of sucked up into this UFO, and he had this encounter, and it was actually printed, I think, in the International UFO Investigator, or it might have been the center's quarterly or whatever that QFOS had, ran across it in there. But it was weird that, you know, in that time period, five abductions within the span of like a week to 10 days, which is very weird.
That's kind of creepy. It's kind of making the hair on the back of my neck stand on end.
Yeah. You know, folks, if you have never gotten lost in David Webb's Year of the Humanoids report, you should really do it, because it's very strange. There's a lot of very strange stuff in there. But like five abduction cases, most of them were in Southern United States. There was one that took place in Arizona, and then another one in Argentina. But all within that short span of time. Just a weird thing. Yeah, it's a very weird thing. But Mark, I can't thank you enough for coming on and talking all about UFOs and all this stuff. If people want to keep up with you, where's the best place to do that?
I am on Twitter, at least for now. I guess I have to say that now. I'm on Twitter at @MarkO'Connell_1. That's O'Connell with two N's and two L's. Also, my podcast, which I don't do nearly as frequently as you do yours. I'm way overdue. I think I'm going to record a new episode of my podcast tomorrow. It's called Farfetched. It's on a platform called Podbean, but you can find it on Apple Podcasts and all the major podcast platforms, I think, carry it. capital F-A-R dash capital F-E-T-C-H-E-D, Farfetched. And you could, it might be easier to look it up under my name, O'Connell. I'm not sure. I'm still a little clumsy with this social media stuff, like how to attract more listeners and stuff. I don't do a very good job of it, but at any rate, Farfetched. But I have to warn people though, Farfetched is not strictly speaking about UFOs. Mm. When I first had an idea for a podcast, my first idea was, hey, I should read all my failed Star Trek pitches. I bet there'd be two or three people in the world who'd listen to those.
Yeah.
So that's what my podcast became. It's basically me reading, basically telling about my life as a writer, but also reading my unsold Star Trek pitches. And there are many. There are many, many unsold Star Trek pitches, believe me. And there are, and I was right, there are two or three people who seem to enjoy listening to them, including my kids. So.
Hey man, when you got your kids on board, like that's important.
Yeah, you're unstoppable.
Exactly, right? No, nobody could take you out at that point.
That's funny stuff, man. And back in the day when I first started all this stuff, my kids would always be like, we need to talk to dad. Is dad all right? That still cracks me up.
Yeah, no, that's great. That is fantastic. Mark, thank you again for joining me. This has been a blast.
Yeah, it's been fun, Rob. I appreciate you inviting me on.
Yeah, absolutely. Special thanks once again to Mark O'Connell for coming on the podcast, telling all these great stories. If you enjoyed it, go give him a follow on Twitter. His feed is really great. Go listen to his podcast, Farfetched. And go pick up a copy of The Close Encounters, man. It is truly one of my favorite UFO books of all time. It's a great biography. It's a great history. And it's really a great addition to any library that has UFO material in it. As for us here at the Our Strange Skies podcast, you can find us on most podcasting apps. If you want to follow us on social media, purchase some merchandise, or find the link to our Patreon page, head on over to OurStrangeSkies.com, your one-stop shop for this podcast. You can find all of that as well as our fantastic digital resource page, which you can get lost in for hours looking through all of these sources. And they're the same sources that I use to make this podcast all the time. Sans, like the books that I use, which I don't use as many books as I've used in the past, mostly because of the time that it takes me to read. I am a very slow reader. So finding these resources has been very handy. If you would like to send me stuff, you can do that. I have a P.O. box. It's P.O. box 1377, Tupper Lake, New York, 12986. And if you haven't already, please go check out Welcome UFO People, the webcomic that I do with my buddy Todd Purse. We put out one a month. And, it's a 5-panel comic that depicts real life UFO encounters, alien encounters, all sorts of strange stuff. So if you really want to check that out, you can follow us on Twitter at Welcome UFO Peeps and Instagram at Welcome UFO People. We do release high res images on our Patreon, and we're working on some like physical media here. We're working on it. Todd's experimenting right now, but we should be getting some like physical prints out there real soon. And when we have enough of them, we're going to collect them. We're going to put them in a zine or a book or something that you guys can get your hands on. So follow along on social media, stay updated about that. And, we just actually released our third installment of it, dedicated to the Bernice Niblett story that we covered on episode 124 with Will Truman. Just it's one of my all-time favorite episodes, one of my all-time favorite stories. So if you want to see that one come to life a little bit, go check out Welcome UFO Peeps and Welcome UFO People Twitter and Instagram, and get a gander at that. Todd really knocked it out of the park on that one. Our Strange Skies is a proud member of Duveed Media. Special thanks to Floats for the use of our theme song, UFO. Go check out Mark's stuff. It's really great. The song UFO is from an album that is ironically titled Not an Album. So go check it out. It's really great. Spencer Worth Davis is the man behind the curtain for this podcast. Our logo was designed by Megan Lagerberg, and the great Desdemona is behind many of our t-shirt designs. And finally, don't forget to look up, because you never know what you'll find in Our Strange Skies or in the pages of the Close Encounters Man. In gray, we trust.
Duveed Media.